Chapter 7. "Having a doze," said Divine. "A bit blasé about new planets by now?"
"Can you see anything?" interrupted Weston.
"I can't manage the shutters, damn them," returned Divine. "We may as well get to the manhole." Ransom awoke from his brown study. The two partners were working together close beside him in the semi-darkness. He was cold, and his body, though in fact much lighter than on Earth, still felt intolerably heavy. But a vivid sense of his situation returned to him. Some fear, but more curiosity. It might mean death, but what a scaffold! Already cold air was coming in from without, and light. He moved his head impatiently to catch some glimpse between the labouring shoulders of the two men. A moment later the last nut was unscrewed. He was looking out through the manhole. Naturally enough, all he saw was the ground. A circle of pale pink, almost of white. Whether very close and short vegetation or very wrinkled and granulated rock or soil, he could not say. Instantly the dark shape of Divine filled the aperture, and Ransom had time to notice that he had a revolver in his hand. "For me, or for Saunz, or for both?" he wondered.
"You next," said Weston curtly.
Ransom took a deep breath, and his hand went to the knife beneath his belt. Then he got his head and shoulders through the manhole, his two hands on the soil of Malacandra. The pink stuff was soft and faintly resilient, like India rubber, clearly vegetation. Instantly Ransom looked up. He saw a pale blue sky. A fine winter morning sky it would have been on Earth. A great billowy cumulus mass of rose colour lower down, which he took for a cloud, and then,
"Get out," said Weston from behind him.
He scrambled through and rose to his feet. The air was cold, but not bitterly so, and it seemed a little rough at the back of his throat. He gazed about him, and the very intensity of his desire to take in the new world at a glance defeated itself. He saw nothing but colours, colours that refused to form themselves into things. Moreover, he knew nothing yet well enough to see it. You cannot see things till you know roughly what they are. His first impression was of a bright, pale world, a watercolour world out of a child's paint-box. A moment later he recognised the flat belt of light blue as a sheet of water, or of something like water, which came nearly to his feet. They were on the shore of a lake or river.
"Now then," said Weston, brushing past him.
He turned and saw, to his surprise, a quite recognisable object in the immediate foreground. A hut of unmistakably terrestrial pattern, though built of strange materials.
"They're human?" he gasped. "They build houses?"
"We do," said Divine. "Guess again." And producing a key from his pocket, proceeded to unlock a very ordinary padlock on the door of the hut. With a not very clearly defined feeling of disappointment or relief, Ransom realized that his captors were merely returning to their own camp. They behaved as one might have expected. They walked into the hut, let down the slats which served for windows, sniffed the close air, expressed surprise that they had left it so dirty, and presently re-emerged.
"We'd better see about the stores," said Weston.
Ransom soon realized that he was to have little leisure for observation and no opportunity of escape. The monotonous work of transferring food, clothes, weapons, and many unidentifiable packages from the ship to the hut kept him vigorously occupied for the next hour or so, and in the closest contact with his kidnappers. But something he learned. Before anything else, he learned that Malacandra was beautiful. And he even reflected how odd it was that this possibility had never entered into his speculations about it. The same peculiar twist of imagination which led him to people the universe with monsters had somehow taught him to expect nothing on a strange planet except rocky desolation, or else a network of nightmare machines. He could not say why, now that he came to think of it. He also discovered that the blue water surrounded them on at least three sides. His view in the fourth direction was blotted out by the vast steel football in which they had come. The hut, in fact, was built either on the point of a peninsula or on the end of an island. He also came little by little to the conclusion that the water was not merely blue in certain lights, like terrestrial water, but really blue. There was something about its behaviour under the very gentle breeze which puzzled him, something wrong or unnatural about the waves. For one thing, they were too big for such a wind, but that was not the whole secret.
They reminded him somehow of the water that he had seen shooting up under the impact of shells in pictures of naval battles. Then suddenly realization came to him. They were the wrong shape, out of drawing, far too high for their length, too narrow at the base, too steep in the sides. He was reminded of something he had read in one of those modern poets about a sea rising in turreted walls.
"Catch!" shouted Devine.
Ransom caught and hurled the parcel on to Weston at the hut door. On one side the water extended a long way, about a quarter of a mile, he thought, but perspective was still difficult in the strange world. On the other side it was much narrower, not wider than 15 feet, perhaps, and seemed to be flowing over a shallow, broken and swirling water that made a softer and more hissing sound than water on earth, and where it washed the hither bank, the pinkish-white vegetation went down to the very brink, there was a bubbling and sparkling which suggested effervescence. He tried hard, in such stolen glances as the work allowed him, to make something out of the farther shore. A mass of something purple, so huge that he took it for a heather-covered mountain, was his first impression. On the other side, beyond the larger water, there was something of the same kind. But there he could see over the top of it. Beyond were strange upright shapes of whitish green, too jagged and irregular for buildings, too thin and steep for mountains. Beyond and above these again was the rose-coloured cloud-like mass. It might really be a cloud, but it was very solid-looking, and did not seem to have moved since he first set eyes on it from the manhole. It looked like the top of a gigantic red cauliflower, or like a huge bowl of red soapsuds, and it was exquisitely beautiful in tint and shape. Baffled by this, he turned his attention to the nearer shore beyond the shallows. The purple mass looked for a moment like a clump of organ pipes, then like a stack of rolls of cloth set up on end, then like a forest of gigantic umbrellas blown inside out. It was in faint motion. Suddenly his eyes mastered the object. The purple stuff was vegetation. More precisely, it was vegetables. Vegetables about twice the height of English elms, but apparently soft and flimsy. The stalks, one could hardly call them trunks, rose smooth and round, and surprisingly thin, for about 40 feet. Above that, the huge plants opened into sheaf-like development, not of branches, but of leaves, leaves large as lifeboats, but nearly transparent. The whole thing corresponded roughly to his idea of a submarine forest. The plants, at once so large and so frail, seemed to need water to support them, and he wondered that they could hang in the air. Lower down, between the stems, he saw the vivid purple twilight, mottled with paler sunshine, which made up the internal scenery of the wood.
"Time for lunch," said Devine suddenly.
Ransom straightened his back. In spite of the thinness and coldness of the air, his forehead was moist. They had been working hard, and he was short of breath. Weston appeared from the door of the hut and muttered something about finishing first. Devine, however, overruled him. A tin of beef and some biscuits were produced, and the men sat down on the various boxes which were still plentifully littered between the spaceship and the hut. Some whiskey, again at Devine's suggestion and against Weston's advice, was poured into the tin cups and mixed with water. The latter, Ransom noticed, was drawn from their own water tins and not from the Blue Lakes. As often happens, the cessation of bodily activity drew Ransom's attention to the excitement under which he had been labouring ever since their landing. Eating seemed almost out of the question. Mindful, however, of a possible dash for liberty, he forced himself to eat very much more than usual, and appetite returned as he ate. He devoured all that he could lay hands on, either of food or drink, and the taste of that first meal was ever after associated in his mind with the first unearthly strangeness, never fully recaptured, of the bright, still, sparkling, unintelligible landscape, with needling shapes of pale green thousands of feet high, with sheets of dazzling blue soda water and acres of rose-red soapsuds. He was a little afraid that his companions might notice and suspect his new achievements as a trencherman, but their attention was otherwise engaged. Their eyes never ceased roving the landscape. They spoke abstractedly and often changed position, and were ever looking over their shoulders. Ransom was just finishing his protracted meal when he saw Devine stiffen like a dog and lay his hand in silence on Weston's shoulder. Both nodded. They rose. Ransom, gulping down the last of his whiskey, rose too. He found himself between his two captors. Both revolvers were out. They were edging him to the shore of the narrow water, and they were looking and pointing across it. At first he could not see clearly what they were pointing at. There seemed to be some paler and slenderer plants than he had noticed before amongst the purple ones. He hardly attended to them, for his eyes were busy searching the ground, so obsessed was he with the reptile fears and insect fears of modern imagining. It was the reflections of the new white objects in the water that sent his eyes back to them. Long, streaky white reflections, motionless in the running water. Four or five, no, to be precise, six of them. He looked up. Six white things were standing there. Spindly and flimsy things, twice or three times the height of a man. His first idea was that they were images of men, the work of savage artists. He had seen things like them in books of archaeology. But what could they be made of, and how could they stand? So crazily thin and elongated in the leg, so top-heavily pouted in the chest, such stalky, flexible-looking distortions of earthly bipeds, like something seen in one of those comic mirrors. They were certainly not made of stone or metal, for now they seemed to sway a little as he watched. Now, with a shock that chased the blood from his cheeks, he saw that they were alive, that they were moving, that they were coming at him. He had a momentary scared glimpse of their faces, thin and unnaturally long, with long drooping noses and drooping mouths of half-spectral, half-idiotic solemnity. Then he turned wildly to fly, and found himself gripped by Divine. "Let me go!" he cried. "Don't be a fool!" hissed Divine, offering the muzzle of his pistol. Then, as they struggled, one of the things sent its voice across the water to them, an enormous horn-like voice far above their heads. "They want us to go across," said Weston. Both the men were forcing him to the water's edge. He planted his feet, bent his back, and resisted donkey-fashion. Now the other two were both in the water, pulling him, and he was still on the land. He found that he was screaming. Suddenly a second, much louder and less articulate noise broke from the creatures on the far bank. Weston shouted too, relaxed his grip on Ransom, and suddenly fired his revolver, not across the water, but up it. Ransom saw why at the same moment. A line of foam, like the track of a torpedo, was speeding towards them, and in the midst of it some large, shining beast. Divine shrieked a curse, slipped and collapsed into the water. Ransom saw a snapping jaw between them, and heard the deafening noise of Weston's revolver again and again beside him, and, almost as loud, the clamour of the monsters on the far bank, who seemed to be taking to the water too. He had had no need to make a decision. The moment he was free, he had found himself automatically darting behind his captors, then behind the spaceship, and on, as fast as his legs could carry him, into the utterly unknown beyond it. As he rounded the metal sphere, a wild confusion of blue, purple, and red met his eyes. He did not slacken his pace for a moment's inspection. He found himself splashing through water and crying out not with pain, but with surprise, because the water was warm. In less than a minute he was climbing out onto dry land again. He was running up a steep incline. And now he was running through purple shadow between the stems of another forest of the huge plants.